Here in South Florida, we're still cleaning up from Irma and trying to help our neighbors in Puerto Rico and in some cases welcome them as new neighbors right here in the state. Republican Congressman Carlos Curbelo of South Miami-Dade County co-sponsored the House amendment that included Puerto Rico in federal hurricane relief. And he joins us now from Washington, D.C. Congressman Curbelo, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be with you.
You signed on your support on a letter from another member of the Florida delegation, Democratic Congressman Darren Soto, asking President Trump for more support for Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. The president said last night that Puerto Rico's debt needs to be wiped out. Today's budget director said more or less not so fast. What do you think of that?
The bottom line is Puerto Rico needs a lot of help. We have to take into account, and maybe some people weren't following it as closely, but before the storm hit, Puerto Rico already had a very serious financial and economic crisis. People have been leaving the island for years. They have massive debt and very little economic growth. So they already were in a very precarious situation, and this hurricane just completely devastated the island. So we need to continue helping them. The administration has now made a new request, almost $30 billion in additional aid, not just for Puerto Rico, but in large part for Puerto Rico. And this is going to be expensive. It's going to take a long time, but we have to help American citizens, which some people don't know this, but all Puerto Ricans are American citizens. We need to help them because they're fellow American citizens and because it's the right thing to do.
Well, the president's getting a lot of criticism for some of his comments that he made while he was in Puerto Rico yesterday. Do you think what's happening in Puerto Rico is, as he said, a real catastrophe like Katrina?
Look, I reject any effort by anyone to politicize this situation. This happened to us last week here on the House floor where we were advancing a tax relief package that included Puerto Rico, U.S. Virgin Islands, even though both representatives in Congress for each of those jurisdictions were in favor of it. Some of my colleagues on the left came and said it wasn't good enough, and they attempted to derail it. That's wrong. And to the extent the president isn't focusing on the task at hand, I think that's a mistake as well. These comparisons to previous natural disasters, again, look, for anyone, even in South Florida, people who lost their homes, who lost all their personal belongings, that is the worst catastrophe for them. So this was devastating for Puerto Rico. It was a massive storm. It was a powerful storm. And we need to help. Katrina was horrifying. It was an event that changed the New Orleans area forever. All of these tragedies are horrible, and the key is for our country, for all of us, to come together to help people in need. That's what I have called for when it comes to my district, especially the people of Monroe County, who took the brunt of Irma. And that's also what the people of Puerto Rico, U.S. Virgin Islands, Texas, and Western Louisiana deserve.
Let me finish this part of Puerto Rico here. I mean, obviously, the island was devastated, and they were already dealing with all of this crippling debt. But really, what else do you propose Congress, the federal government, do in helping Puerto Rico?
So we need to continue, make sure the aid continues to flow. That's first and foremost, help people get power back on, help clear the roads, right? All the basic fundamental needs that that any society has. And then going forward, we need to stimulate economic development in Puerto Rico. That is their only chance at getting through this and emerging from it stronger. There is a federal board that is overseeing the island's finances. That board needs to, on the one hand, give the Puerto Rican government the ability to and the flexibility to recover from the hurricane, and then on the other hand, make sure that the government there builds a fiscally sustainable future for Puerto Rico. It is amazing that a small island like Puerto Rico has accumulated over $70 billion in debt over time, and that's just not sustainable. None of our states would be able to do that, and many would argue that the federal government is already doing it, and that's very dangerous. So I think those are the two main priorities. Make sure we get all of the aid they need there as soon as possible and without interruption. And secondly, help them develop their economy so that they can be self-sustaining and so that people can have a future in Puerto Rico if they want to stay there.
Let's move over to issues of immigration. Obviously, before the hurricane, there was a lot of talk of how to deal with kids protected by DACA. That is President Obama's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. You have a plan. There are other plans being discussed in Congress. You have one called Recognizing America's Children Act. Reading through it, similar, a little more restrictive than DACA, but really, what kind of support do you have for that right now?
So there are three bills in the House right now that would afford Dreamers a permanent solution. And what I have said is that I'm prepared to support any of them, because this is not about who gets credit. It's about doing the right thing by these young people. And as the title of my bill indicates, Recognizing America's Children, I consider them American. They were raised in our country. They were educated here. They speak English. They're friends with our kids. So the law needs to recognize them. I believe they are already Americans. They're de facto Americans. As a matter of fact, just to correct you, my bill is actually more generous than DACA, than the executive order. DACA has an age cap. My legislation doesn't. DACA covers about 800,000 people. Mine covers around 1 million. And mine captures people who arrived from 2007 to through 2012, which DACA is only pre-2007. So of the three bills, mine is the one that most closely tracks the DACA program that President Obama signed into law. And I think it's where a potential compromise exists. There's the DREAM Act, which, again, I support. But it covers almost 2 million people, more than double the DACA population. And then there's the HOPE Act, Congressman Gutierrez, which I would be prepared to vote for, but that one is even more expansive. I think we have to reach an agreement as to who are the individuals we're trying to help. My understanding is that the focus is on the DACA population, on the young people who today are beneficiaries of that executive order. If we can expand that a little more, I am all for that. What I'm fearful of is that either side gets too ambitious and it derails the possibility of getting this done. Having said that, I feel as confident as I ever have that we are going to get a permanent solution for these young people so that they can live the rest of their lives happily, fully incorporated into the American experience and without any fear of deportation.
Now, you're confident that it can't, that you can find that solution. Do you think it can happen this year?
The goal for most people around here that I've talked to on both sides of the aisle is to get this done before the end of the year. I think if we let this spill over into next year, we start getting close to that March deadline. A lot of these young people are going to feel a great deal of anxiety. They're going to be very worried. I think it would be a mistake to let this debate spill over into next year. I think it's something that should get done by the end of the year, and that seems to be the consensus right now.
I can't let you go without asking you. We had the shooting in Las Vegas, and we now have, 58 confirmed victims and hundreds injured. Do you want to comment on that first?
Yes. First and foremost, obviously, we accompany the families of the victims. This is horrifying. It is, I think, the worst thing that I have seen on television. Those images were just very disconcerting. Some ask what to do next, what can Congress do, and I definitely think that we need to revisit the issue of gun safety. A question that I have started asking around here is why are these bump stocks legal, these devices that essentially turn semi-automatic weapons into automatic weapons, which are illegal. People are not supposed to have automatic weapons under the law. And these bump stocks essentially convert weapons into automatic weapons. Clear circumvention of the law, a blatant circumvention of the law, and I believe that this presents an opportunity for Republicans and Democrats to finally come together, build consensus around common sense gun policies in this country.
But
last Congress, I filed a version of the no-fly, no-buy legislation that would have prevented or could have prevented the tragedy at the Pulse nightclub. We're looking at that legislation as well, but I think right now the best candidate for a common denominator is to focus on these bump stock devices, which was so deadly and so potent.
Well, Congressman,
Vegas tragedy.
If I may, because it's interesting that you say that, is when do we start talking about any kind of gun legislation? Because as we heard from the White House, and this comes up every mass shooting, we've heard the same answer. This is not the time to talk about it. The problem is we've had too many of these, a lot of these in the last couple of years. So how do we bring up this conversation? How do you propose that we even start talking about it?
Well, we've already started talking about it here on the air on your show, and many colleagues here in the Congress are already talking about it. I think most people want to be sensitive to the victims and those who are mourning, so I don't think the day of or the day after is the right time to begin a debate about policy, but certainly that time is very soon. I mean, we need to provide some answers, some solutions. And again, these conversations have already started, at least privately, and I think you'll soon see that some members will be speaking up more and more about finding a bipartisan consensus around sensible gun policy in this country. And again, these bump stocks, I've even spoken to people who are involved in the gun manufacturing business, and they have told me that these things should not be legal. So I really see that for the first time, we may have a chance at getting a bipartisan solution to this this great challenge in our country.
And is it just, I mean, because we talk about, it's not just in this situation, in this particular shooting, it was also the fact that, you know, this gentleman had many guns, assault rifles that he had actually had converted, as we've been talking about with these devices, into automatic weapons, not semi-automatic weapons. And these are things that you can hear in the videos. Is there at any point going to be a discussion or need to be a discussion about the types of weapons, not just devices on weapons, but the types of weapons? Some of these weapons are military weapons. Do we have to have that conversation?
I certainly think there's room for that, but my focus is on getting something done. And I think our best chance at getting something done is starting with this bump stock issue. Again, I have filed no-fly, no-buy legislation in the previous Congress, looking at filing that again. There's a key provision there that's very important to me that focuses on individuals who have been under investigation by the FBI in the past for links to terrorism. Like the perpetrator at the Pulse was, my legislation would have made it very difficult for him to purchase any firearm. So we're talking to my Democratic partner on that legislation about refiling. We were having that conversation already. Now we obviously have a greater sense of urgency. But I think our best chance is to begin by putting the spotlight on these bump stocks, which, in my opinion, have no place in anyone's hands.
We've been talking with Republican Congressman Carlos Curbelo of South Miami-Dade County, again talking about Puerto Rico aid and discussing gun legislation. Congressman, always a pleasure. Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Happy to be on anytime. Thanks. Have a good day.
Welcome back to Sundial here on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, many of you listening have friends and loved ones in some of the other Caribbean islands affected this hurricane season. And we're going to check in now with Marine Colonel Michael Samarov. He's the head of the Joint Task Force in the Leeward Islands, which is helping to distribute humanitarian aid. Colonel Samarov, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Right now, by the way, because you've been traveling around the islands, where are you located right now?
I'm calling you from Fort-de-France, Martinique. We've been up and out down the eastern Caribbean, but that's where we are now.
No, we've seen all the footage of the devastation in St. Martin after Hurricane Irma, Dominica, and so forth. How are things right now? Tell us what you've seen.
Well, we were activated on the 9th of September, specifically for St. Martin, and that's where we started to work. Before Irma, St. Martin was a green island. When we arrived there, I mean, it's hard to describe. Every bit, every leaf was ripped off every single tree. It was almost a stubble of just wood that was left. Buildings were destroyed, and maybe most remarkably, you'd walk or drive along the roads, and you would see boats, sailboats. It was a large attraction for folks who like to sail, literally sitting on well into dry land where it was deposited by the violence of the storm. The good news now is that both the French and Dutch sides of St. Martin are better off. We ceased military operations there on the 28th, and here on Martinique, I saw some of our French partners that worked with their return yesterday. So things there are on the mend, St. Martin.
When you go in with the task force, really, how do you even begin the process? You think about all this devastation, trees down, power lines down. You may have water and sewage lines broken. And, you know, again, it's trying to figure out, find the people and make sure that people are safe. But really, I mean, when you're coming in, help me understand how you assess the situation.
Well, we're fortunate in that within the U.S. government, we work with USAID and specifically with OFDA, the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance. They're really the experts in assessing the situation. They understand the needs of a community facing a disaster, and they also have close linkages with the international, national, and non-governmental relief community. They come in, and working together with their partners, they determine the needs. Now, within those needs, they understand what are the unique capabilities that the Department of Defense can provide. We work with them to provide those unique capabilities. And that's a great partnership, and we've been really privileged to work with some tremendous USAID OFDA professionals throughout these two storms.
What kind of aid is it that you're bringing in? What sort of supplies do you bring in?
So in St. Martin, we did a couple of things. Princess Juliana Airport had sustained some pretty significant damage. What we were able to do was provide some initial help with running that airfield, the air traffic control piece. The other thing is all of their material handling equipment, forklifts, the heavy ones have been severely damaged. So, you have a large airplane with aid arrive, but you have no way to load all of those heavy materials onto trucks for onward movement to the population. So we were able to bring in military forklifts and assist with that. Additionally, there was a significant requirement for water, in particular on the French side of St. Martin, the north side. There is no fresh water on St. Martin. Everything comes from desalinization plants. The French were able to get their desal plant up. The problem is when the pipes depressurized and repressurized, there was significant damage, so they couldn't distribute. So we helped with water distribution, and really the way we could do that is with some very small mobile desalinization units that we could put within the affected communities and really make water at the source, allowing people simply to come and get water. The other thing we were able to do is, we were there post-Irma, but then as Maria came, there was a requirement for water on the island, and we were able to fly in, well, I believe we flew in over 100 tons of bottled water that could be distributed on the island. Finally, we brought in a ship on the Dutch side with a variety of supplies that, again, through our USAID and OFDA friends, who we worked with side by side through all of this, we're able to distribute to the local population. I think it's important to note that we did all those things with as light a military touch as possible, keeping our allies, the French and the Dutch, and local officials up front helping their community. I think that's very important.
Where are you going to be going next?
Okay, so we're already there. As Maria rolled in, we anticipated that there would be other taskings. We pulled back off of St. Martin, believe it or not, to Puerto Rico. We spent, most of us spent Maria on Puerto Rico. Then when the storm passed, we had staged our equipment, our personnel, and helicopters on the island. We were able to pull all of that out. At that point, we were informed that the island of Dominica, further south, had sustained severe damage. And we quickly moved, working with our French allies, basing on the two islands north and south of Dominica, Guadeloupe to the north, Martinique to the south. And we began work on Dominica. Just as in St. Martin, we're doing two things. The first thing is we're helping American citizens affected by these disasters to safety. On Dominica in particular, there's fresh water, so we were less in the business of fresh water. But there, the road network sustained severe damage. And the terrain is much more mountainous, so the roads were difficult even before the storm. We did a lot of distribution of supplies, both food items and then non-food items, like USAID OFTA provided plastic sheeting, some cooking utensils and supplies so that people who were devastated could have something to cook in, water storage, and I believe we distributed some pipes for plumbing. The other thing is we assisted with reconnaissance of the roads to help the aid community better understand what the requirements were. And in each of these cases, we moved local aid officials and local police so that aid could be distributed in a secure environment where the most needy people, the most vulnerable people, could receive support.
Well, I really appreciate it. I know that you're pressed for time. You're very busy, and I really appreciate the fact that you could join us today, Colonel Samaroff, to give us this update because we wanted to get the best picture we could of really everything that's been going on throughout the Caribbean. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Again, that is Colonel Michael Samaroff. He is Marine Colonel Michael Samaroff, head of the Joint Task Force in the Leeward Islands, giving us again an update on some of the other islands. And listen, we want to hear from you if you have family, friends, loved ones in any of the areas that were devastated by Hurricane Maria. Find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial. Let us know your story. Maybe you have a question. Maybe we can help find those answers. All right, let's change things up. We're going to take a break and come back and lighten the mood up a little bit. If you didn't hear, the Marlins have new owners. Does that mean you're going to get excited about baseball again? I want to hear from you, 800-743-9576. Tell us, will you love the Marlins again? That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. All right, so let's lighten the mood up a little bit. If you hadn't heard, we're in a new era for the Miami Marlins baseball team. Yes, they have new owners. The Miami Marlins have new owners. Yesterday, controlling owner Bruce Sherman and the face of the Marlins, probably New York Yankee great Derek Jeter, announced the ownership of the team is switching over into their hands. Jeter said it's all about bringing the fans back.
We are focused on bringing the fans back, and we want to build an organization that's sustainable over time.
And then, of course, Bruce Sherman, not as outspoken as Jeter, but he's excited about this.
And we're excited, especially excited, the community. I've lived in Florida 38 years. I'm just so excited about this, and we know we have a lot of work ahead of us, and with Derek's leadership, I know we'll get there.
All right, what does this mean for the Marlins, and can they build a winner? But better yet, really, with the new ownership, will you start loving the Marlins again? Will you go to the games? Because let's be honest, I've been to a couple of games this year, and the stands are empty. 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. Also find us on Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Is this a new era for the Marlins? Are they going to get can we get excited about the team again? Joining me now is Timothy Healy. He writes for the Sun Sentinel. He's joining us via Skype. Timothy, great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us is Clark Spencer. He writes, he covers the Marlins for the Miami Herald, and he's joining us as well. Clark, great to have you.
Good morning, or I guess it's afternoon.
Good afternoon, yeah, of course. All right, Derek Jeter did go on to say something else really important. I wanted to hear this real quick. All right, do we have that cut from Jeter?
All You'll right. hear words coming from this organization like community, culture, communication, patience. You're going to hear that over and over. Because in order for this organization to be successful, we're going to have to focus on those things. Our fans, they are our number one priority.
All right. Something he said in there, I want to ask both of you about patience. We got to have patience. We're Marlins fans. We've been patient for a long time. Timothy, what does that mean? What is he trying to tell us?
He's trying to tell you that the on-field product the next couple of years may not be too pretty, but that over the long haul, they hope to build something special.
And over the long haul, what does that mean?
Over the long haul, that means essentially the predicament the Marlins find themselves in right now is they have several very good players, but they are still a losing team. And so the idea is, the expectation is, externally at least, and internally, if you talk to the Marlins people, that they're basically going to have to start over, get rid of all of their good players, and rebuild, much as the Chicago Cubs and Houston Astros have done in recent years. And essentially that means losing now. The 2018 Marlins may not be too exciting, but it's all part of a longer rebuilding process by 2020, 2021, maybe in that neighborhood if they play their cards right.
All right. We'll talk about this, what they're going to be doing with current players. Clark Spencer, he said it's all about the fans and getting the fans back and making it about them. But what's your take on what you heard from Derek Jeter and Bruce Sherman?
Well, in terms of the general press conference yesterday, which went for about 30 minutes, there were a lot of questions and not a lot of specific answers. They spoke in vague generalities about what they wanted to do. Of course, they want to reengage with fans and increase attendance. Of course, they want to put a winner on the field. But these things aren't done easily. I mean, these are two major obstacles with this franchise. And in terms of attendance, this is something they've battled for, two decades now. Wayne Huizenga finally threw in the towel. He was the original owner when he couldn't make it work with crowds. John Henry was only here for a couple seasons, and then Jeffrey Loria has been in charge for, 16, 17 years, and it hasn't worked. I mean, they built a new ballpark. They thought that would work with a retractable roof. That hasn't worked. So this is a major challenge, and it's going to be difficult to try to turn things around in terms of crowds.
Oh, all right. I hope that's not a sign of what's to come. All right, I just heard something crash, but I hope that's not a sign of what's to come.
It might have been a Giancarlo Stanton home run crashing through your window or something like that.
Well, that would have been 60 if he had done it before the season ended. 800-743-9576. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Again, the fact that we have new owners. So we're hearing be patient. This could take time to build a team, but really, what is it going to take to get you, the fans, back into the stands, get the fans back to loving the team again? Clark Spencer, the other thing, too, is this that kind of blew my mind. $1.2 billion-plus for the team, that's the Marlins. If they're worth that much, I can't even begin to fathom what maybe the Yankees or Cubs are worth. But why was it so big a number?
Because there aren't many pros sports franchises out there, and there's only 30 in baseball and about the same number in the NBA and NFL and hockey. They're just very few, and there are not many of them out there, and they don't go on the market very often. So the price has risen greatly over the last 10 years with these franchises.
Timothy Healy, the other thing too is talking about this ownership. And we talk a lot about Derek Jeter, but the controlling owner is Bruce Sherman. And I believe it's almost half of the value of the team. But who is this guy? He's, as we heard from the clip, he's lived here in South Florida for many years. But who's Bruce Sherman?
He is a retired money manager who lives in Naples. And he's the most interesting part to me there is retired. He hasn't worked full time really in a couple of years. And now he's all of a sudden thrust into Major League Baseball ownership, which I think is fascinating. We don't totally know yet why he wanted to buy the Marlins. He said when he heard they were for sale, he ended up partnering with Derek Jeter, but they didn't go into real detail on how that came to be or what his desires are as far as owning a team. You know, as he, you know, gets towards 70 years old now, he's 69 right now.
Let's not forget that at the very beginning, it was Jeter with Jeb Bush.
Sure.
There was a Romney involved. There were all these different people who wanted to be part of the team, and then it was like musical chairs, and this is the team that we have. Let me go to the phones again, asking you the question, your thoughts. With this new ownership, are you excited about baseball in South Florida again? And if anything, what do you want the new owners to do to win you over and get you back out there? And I'm not convinced. I don't even know yet if I'm gonna love the Marlins again. But well, I'll save that for later. Let me go to Roy in Coconut Grove. Roy, how are you feeling right now about the Marlins?
Hi, I have a couple of basic thoughts. I was one of the first who left the stadium and never wanted to go back after Samson and Loria pulled their little shenanigans. And I think Jeter, because of his inexperience, he's thinking that a, quote, winning team is going to bring the fans back. And I look back to the teams that I always liked. Loved the Mets. The Mets were in the cellar for years, and their stadium was packed. Okay? So these initial mistakes Jeter's made, he's going to get a pass on those regarding the initial firings of Jeff Conine, Jack McKeon.
Yeah, we got to talk about that.
Terrible, terrible situation. And then he called him back and said, oh, by the way, I'm not firing you guys. And then he was noncommittal on Giancarlo Stanton, the home run king. So, Derek, to get the fans back, you want to make it exciting. Personally, and I'm a longtime baseball fan, I could care less if we win or even have a winning season. I want to go there to have fun. I want to see Stanton knock balls out of the park. I want to see Jeff Conine announcing, Jack McKeon smoking his cigar. And that's what
you want to see
as a fan wants. If he wants to then slowly over the next 5 to 7 years build the team, bring in totally unknowns, that's fine.
Okay.
Keep the core.
Roy, thank you so much for your thoughts. I appreciate that. And, sure. And I'm glad you brought up the stadium, too. You know what? I'm going to ask about that just real quickly. Clark Spencer, that was one of the big things about the, you know, with the fans being angry with Loria, Jeffrey Loria, the former owner now, is the fact that, okay, we had this, it's a beautiful stadium, really expensive. The taxpayers are going to be on the hook for a while. Can they get over that?
In terms of what, winning?
Can the fans get over that anger over the stadium and then want to come back and support the team?
You mean the stadium being built using taxpayer money?
Right.
Well, I mean, there are baseball fans who don't care that it came from the taxpayers paid for it, and there are taxpayers who do care, you know. So, what I see here is, look, they built the ballpark opened in 2012. They went crazy with payroll. They signed major free agents, Jose Reyes, Mark Burley, others. They still lost. And so then they gutted that roster and tried to start over again. That angered a lot of people, and they haven't recovered. They still don't draw. They're ranked, I think, 28th in the majors in attendance this year, ahead of only Tampa and Oakland. You know, I don't know what it's going to take for fans to come back. I mean, winning certainly, but Jeter's got he's in a tough spot here. He's got to go out and try to like re-engage fans. At the same time, he's going to tear up the roster most likely.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Trade some of these core players. That's going to be hard to do.
I want to ask. I want to ask about that. I want to ask about the fans here in a minute. But you know, we start talking baseball, and now Everybody wants to jump in on this conversation, and that's good. I'm glad. That's what I want to have. But all right, so Peter Maritz has joined us in studio, and our program director, and he's a baseball fan because, Peter, we talk about this. You go to a certain number of games every year. I've been to a few a year.
Yeah,
right?
About 8 or 10 games a year, it seems like, for me.
Let's start with this. Are you excited about this? What do you think about this?
Yeah, I'm excited about the potential because I think there's some serious work to be done, and the way things have been done in the past has not worked. So my biggest concern is pitching, because look, we've got a team
pitching, yes,
that is fielding, tied for number one in fielding percentage, tied for number one in lack of errors. Their batting average is, I think, fifth or sixth in the league. That's all in place. But the pitching has been an ongoing problem. How many times the Marlins have been ahead and have lost a game because their bullpen blows the game,
so,
and
you
there are
know,
very
you,
few people in the starting rotation that
you,
are.
You know, strong. Peter's a baseball guy. That's he's throwing stats. He knows his he knows the team. He knows the numbers. But the other thing too, we heard just now from a caller was the stadium thing. The whole stadium thing. Is that a big deal to you?
No, because it's a beautiful park. I'm over it.
You're
you know,
over
it. It concerned me at the time, but I love going.
Is it winning that brings fans back, or is it something else? What do you think Jeter has to do to convince people, please come to the games?
It's winning, and it's the superstars. That's why I'm concerned about the Giancarlo thing, and I don't really know how much offing him would provide in the way of extra revenue or resources for the team.
He has a very big contract. Let me go back to the phones. I've got Mike in Boca Raton talking about players who shouldn't be let go. Mike, what are you thinking? Yeah.
I'm thinking that the first top six guys on the roster down the six are very good players. Not obviously they're not all Stanton, but the rest of them are really good players. They're hitters. They can throw. They can do everything. The first six. After that, you got a couple of guys, and after that, you got a bunch of pitchers that are mediocre. And less. And I think I don't think the people that are buying this, I think that they understand that, because they're good. Jeter's a great baseball guy, and I think that he will understand how good he has a start with. Now what he has to do is to fill in the rest, but I think he has a really good good group.
All right. And, of course, I mean, yeah, that's we've already heard it a couple of times. I mean, there are a couple of big players. Obviously, Stanton's one of them. Should we get rid of them? I mean, you got to keep your stars. But let's find out about that. Mike, thanks so much for the call. I appreciate it. You know what? Timothy Healy, Stanton, 59 home runs, by the way, this year. Just a couple from you know, the Maris record, the original record. But just big numbers. He's kind of a big star, right? I mean, he's not Jose Fernandez star, but big star, but a big contract. What do you think is going to happen to him?
My expectation is that he will not be a Marlin in 2018. And I know that stings, that if and when it happens, it'll sting for the fan base. And as Clark mentioned, it puts Jeter in an awfully difficult predicament of, you know, trying to give the team a fresh start, but then giving off the appearance of, oh, the same old Marlins trading their best players. But to me, the primary benefit of a theoretical Stanton trade would be the resources they don't have to expend on keeping him. He's due $295 million over the next 10 years. And if you start over from a roster perspective for the Marlins, the economics of baseball and the economics of the Marlins specifically wouldn't really allow for you to keep a player like that.
All right. Again, we're talking about the Miami Marlins. They have new owners. Derek Jeter, former New York Yankee great, is one of those owners. He's a minority owner, but he's going to be the face of this team moving forward. And really, the question today is this. How do you feel about the new owners? How do you feel about, you know, perhaps a new era for Marlins baseball? Can you get excited about Marlins baseball again? Because let's face it, if you haven't been to a game lately, well, a lot of people don't go to games that much anymore. I want to hear from you, your thoughts. What is it going to take for you to be a baseball fan again in South Florida? Give us a call and give us those thoughts. That's 800-743-9576. We're going to continue this conversation on the other side. Again, Marlins baseball, a new era has begun here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. So we're going to wrap up the show here talking about the Marlins. Again, yesterday announced that they have new owners, Bruce Sherman and Derek Jeter. There are actually more owners than that, but those are the two big faces of the team ownership right now. Derek Jeter, of course, former New York Yankee, great shortstop. And so he's talking about being patient. They're going to build this team from the bottom up. But really, what I've been asking today of you is, are you going to be a fan again? Will you love the team again? Or are you just going to wait? We want a winning team, and if there's a winning team, I'll support it. Let's go to the phones. I want to start with Oscar in Miami Lakes. All right, Oscar, what are your thoughts on this new ownership?
Hey, guys, listen up. It's really exciting. I can't lie to you. But what is it going to take to win? You guys talked about the team selling off players. It's not cheating the fans. We've been cheated multiple times. And when you get cheated a few times, you might end up being single, right? You end up in a divorce, and you just don't wanna be with anybody, you know? So I'd rather be single. But I'm excited. I'm willing to take a look at it. I see that that press conference looked a little bit not too strong. I didn't hear the strong words, passionate words, commitment for a long run. So I want to see how committed they are for the long run, and don't sell off Stanton. That's it.
All right, Oscar, thanks so much. Very well put, by the way. You know what, Clark Spencer, the Miami Herald. Okay, we talked about this from the press conference yesterday, is that, and we've heard actually for the last couple of days, that, you know, they're going to build this team from the bottom up. And, of course, it always comes back to Stanton. We already heard from Timothy Healy. He told us about what may happen. Do you think Stanton's gone? And if so, what do we replace him with?
I agree with Tim. I don't think Giancarlo Stanton will be a Marlin after this season. We're talking $295 million contract, which you have to question whether a market such as South Florida's and the low attendance as they have can really sustain that kind of a contract. He's going to make $25 million next year. They have, I think, seven or eight players on the books for next season that are going to cost them $95 million. And, you know, this is not a market that's, you know, this isn't New York. They can't have a $200 million payroll. It's not Boston. It's not Chicago. It's not L.A. This is a low-revenue market. And the problem that you're dealing with the Marlins right now is that, yes, they have some very good core players in their lineup, not just Giancarlo Stanton, but Christian Yelich and J.T. Realmuto, Marcell Ozuna, D. Gordon. It's a good lineup, but they have no foundation. This is a house with no foundation. Their minor league system is one of the worst, if not the worst, in the majors in terms of talent, and they need to start rebuilding that. That's how franchises like this succeed, these smaller markets, to have a good farm system. And as Tim mentioned earlier, Houston did it. A lot of teams go through rebuilds. Cincinnati, Atlanta's a good example right now. Philadelphia. I mean, these things happen. They go through cycles. And so I think fans have to understand, and I know it hurts to lose major players like that, and it happened before with Miguel Cabrera when he was a Marlin and they had to trade him. But these are natural cycles with teams, and to get a fresh start, I think they're going to have to trade some of these core players.
All right. Let me take a couple more quick calls here. I'm going to start with Emilio in North Miami Beach. You've got concerns about keeping that roster intact, but Emilio, you're hearing Stanton's likely gone, a few of these guys probably gone. Well, how does that make you feel?
Well, first of all, hi. Thanks for having me on. And it's exciting to see that there's, you know, new management in the Marlins organization. But I think I agree with one of the other comments before, where it seems like we are a baseball farm that creates superstars for other teams. Every time we have a good team, I understand the payroll, I understand everything, but that's why fans get disheartened and don't go to the games. It's happened ever since, you know, after the two World Series that we won, both teams got dismantled. It's happening now with trying to, you know, get Giancarlo sold to another team. So that's why people, you know, just don't continue to back the Marlins, because every time you put your heart into them, you know, it gets ripped out.
Yeah, no. Listen, that's I agree. Been down here long enough. I know this team. It's one in its short history. It's won two championships, but then of course your heart gets ripped out because they dump all the players. All right, hey Emilio, thanks so much. I appreciate the comments. Let me go to Patrick joining us in West Palm Beach. You're excited about this, Patrick?
Yeah, I'm excited to be rid of Loria.
Okay, all right.
mainly because the future, he proved what he did in Montreal, and then he came and did the same exact thing here. And so now the future is at least positive in terms of talking about building things. But, you know, having the community vested in their heroes, and keeping, if possible, keeping them, but also building new ones through the farm system. I think that, you know, the Heat, when they had their Wade and their top three, you know, they have a great following. It's very possible to do the same thing with any team as long as you have the fans vested in it and feel like they're part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll wait and see. The guys just took over. They've been owners for barely a day. Let's see what happens. Patrick, thanks so much for the comments. All right, let me finish up with this. Timothy Healy joining us via Skype real quickly. You know what? Going forward, we heard about one fan saying there it's because Jeffrey Loria is out. What's his legacy?
His legacy is one of widespread hatred, but also he did get the ballpark built. So the public perception will be overall extremely negative, but it's hard to ignore the gigantic ballpark in Little Havana. So the legacy, not a great one, let's say.
All right. And Clark Spencer of the Miami Herald, you guys are telling us, be patient. Team's not going to be that good. A lot of different faces next year.
Correct. And I just want to remind folks that, you know, when Wayne Huizenga left, he was more despised at that time than Jeffrey Loria is now as the outgoing owner. As we recall, you know, the Marlins won that 97 World Series, and they had the fire sale of all fire sales.
Yes.
I mean, they just unloaded everybody. And when the Marlins, and this is kind of a misconception, when the Marlins won their 03 World Series, they didn't dismantle that team right away. They kept most of that unit intact in 04 and 05, and they had winning records. And the fans still didn't turn out. And so that's the question. Even if you keep players and even if they win, is this market really there to support it?
That's for another show. Is this a market for baseball? All right. Clark Spencer writes for the Miami Herald. We also heard from Timothy Healy joining us via Skype. He writes for the Sun Sentinel. Gentlemen, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Anytime. Thank you.
And we want to hear your thoughts. You can find us again on Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Let us know your thoughts. Are you excited about the new ownership?